You got one more? You're done. Okay. I just saw you pushing pedals, and I think you crank it up. You are weaker than you think. The other part of that is you're needier than you know. And as men who want to act like men, it's not uncommon to think that you're strong enough in your masculinity and in your strength as a man, because it's not popular to be weak or to be vulnerable. But as a Christian, it's wise to be humble in recognition that you are needier than you know, you are weaker than you think, and periodically you'll be reminded of that. Maybe you'll go through an extended season that is meant to reveal that. But here's some really good news, and that is, my grace, said Jesus, it's sufficient for you. Sufficient means it's enough. All that you need in your weakness, He possesses. And His power is made perfect. Teleos, it reaches its fullest expression in your astheneo, when you have nothing. It's not like you have a little bit. It's not like you have assets you can resource. You have nothing. My power is made perfect when you have nothing. It reaches its fullest expression. And Paul, who understood that, like an epiphany after begging for relief, I sought the Lord for relief. His answer to me was not relief, but this promise: my grace is sufficient, my power is made perfect in your weakness. And Paul said, therefore, I'm going to what? Glory in my weakness. I'm going to boast in it. What does that mean? It means I'm going to embrace it, not as a burden to carry, but as an opportunity and a stage upon which God can display His unrivaled glory. Your weakness, whether it's in your home, it's in your heart, it's your marriage, it's relationships, maybe it's illness, as it is in my home, is a staging ground for the greatest display of God you will ever see and others will ever witness, because my power is made perfect in your weakness. Therefore, I can boast, for when I am weak, that I'm what? I'm strong. Now, gentlemen, you're going to learn that somewhere, somehow, someday. And you may be in a season right now where you're challenged. And you go, oh man, I've heard some things. God's spoken to me. I have no idea in my current condition how I'm going to get where He wants me to be. The good news is, He who began the good work is faithful to finish it until the day of Jesus Christ. Your hope is in our Rescuer, not in yourself. You conform, you comply, you cooperate, you seek the wisdom from above because you lack it, and let God do what God does for His glory. Don't be discouraged. Greater is He that is in you than he that is in the world. Whatever your deal is, He's good enough for it. Remember what Paul prayed in Ephesians chapter 1. I pray that the eyes of your heart might be enlightened. The word enlightened, see what you've never seen before in a way you've never seen it. The eyes of your heart may be enlightened so that you may know the hope of your calling. The hope of your calling means that's the hope of a new beginning. It's the hope of presently changing. And it's a guaranteed happy ending for a Christian. That's your hope, because it's His grace, strength, and power, not your own. It's not your resolve. It's your submission. It's His power, and it's His work to His glory. As a matter of fact, he says just below, the enlightened, praying that the eyes of your heart can see the hope and the riches of your inheritance to come towards us who believe. But it says it's also that you might know the power toward us who believe, demonstrated in the resurrection of Jesus Christ, elevated above all powers to the highest station and the highest place. I want you to know that, Paul said, because you need to remember that you are needier than you know, weaker than you think, but He is more powerful than you can imagine. That's our hope. Can you say amen to that? Amen. So there's no reason to leave discouraged if God's God, if He is who He says He is, and He can do what He says He can do. Let Him do it. because he wants the world to see it, and he wants you to enjoy what only he can do. There's benefit in weakness. You get to see God in ways you otherwise would not. All right, 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Subject today is productively promoting Christ in your family. And the reason I chose this subject is because I like how applicational it is, because whether you're a father, whether you're a grandfather, whether you're a big brother, whether you're a good friend, these principles can apply to you. In my living quarters for this weekend. By the way, I did not sleep good last night, Ramey. By the way, thank you for the music. You and Ron and Jeff, thank you for your leadership. And I'm grateful. Every pastor knows the value of having an ally that can cultivate a high view of God and engage the hearts of those who are going to hear God's word with the message of music and song and instruments that kind of open up our heart to hear it. So thank you. Truly appreciate it. So not just the musical part, but also the ministry part that I experienced. In my living quarters, and I woke up at 2 this morning. My bed was fine. Nobody was snoring unless it was me. But I could not go back to sleep, and so I may be a bit frosty today. I'm trying to remember why I'm telling you that. Oh, just as a disclaimer, that's what that is. That's a disclaimer, Bob. Hey, help me. If I'm in a black church, I'm saying I'm going to need some help today. I need some witnesses to help me preach. Yeah. I might say, talk to me. Come on now. Do I have a witness? I spent a summer in South Central L.A. with Dr. E.V. Hill. Do you know that name? Edward Victor Hill. I spent a summer with Dr. Hill in South Central L.A., and I learned the art of talking to the preacher. And I was a seminary student. I had a team of collegians with me and 1,700 black folks wall to wall. And, I mean, man, it was an adventure every Sunday. You got your money's worth. You started 9-ish and went home at 1-ish. Preaching, offering a couple of times, lots of worship. But, you know, I had the opportunity as a seminary student to preach to that church, and I was terrified. I had not spoken a lot at that point in my educational journey, and Dr. Hill was going to be away, and he wanted me to preach. And so, well, you're not going to say no, are you? Are you going to fake illness and say, I can't? No, you're going to have to stand up and deliver. And I'll tell you what, it may have been the best sermon I've ever preached and the easiest sermon I've ever preached. Because I told them at the end, you just picked me up and carried me all the way home, just the way they talk. So if I get sluggish today, will you help me? Just reach out and grab me and pick me up. In my living quarters, over here, there's a placard on the wall. It's not very decorative, but it makes a powerful statement that's applicable this morning. 3 John, verse 4. I have no greater joy than my children walk in the truth. Now, I'm 57 years and I have two children. 57 years old, I have two children. I can tell you that though we have illness in my home, I still have no greater joy because my son walks in the truth, as does my daughter. I'm going to argue that at the end of things, you're going to agree with me somewhere, someday, that there is no higher priority beyond loving your wife, and that is investing in your children. If you're a father or a grandfather, and I had the privilege of having two grandfathers in my life, both knew the Lord. My son is named for my maternal grandfather, Prince of a Godly Man. They were major influencers in my life. You can be a major influence in somebody's life. When I left Shades Mountain back in April a year ago, I told my wife, it's like I went to my funeral and I didn't have to die. Because people will rehearse your influence in their life. And my son was a witness to that. And I said, Parker, I said, do understand that what just happened is what you want at the end of your life. You want people to say, his life positively impacted my life. Here's a statement I want you to hear. I want you to invest your life, not spend it. I want you to invest your life, not spend it. Because some things are more valuable than other things. And the things the world promotes as valuable are not nearly as valuable as the influence you can have in the life of another human being, particularly your children, the people you love. And what I want to do this morning is give you a biblical paradigm, a pathway, a pattern employed by Paul that I think is the best picture of how to maximize your influence with the people you care about and engage in life. How to invest your life productively to promote Christ in your family, really in anybody's life. The beauty of this pattern, it's about being an agent of influence, an impact player for Christ. So if you have a family, use this. If you have friends, use this. Anyone can be impacted by this paradigm. That's why I like this. 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. Paul's in southern Greece. He is in Corinth writing back to Thessalonica, which was the Roman government seat in Macedonia. Macedonia is the northern part of Greece. Achaia, southern part of Greece. It's the spring. He was there in the summer late, Thessalonica, and he's writing a letter. And he's going to say some things to this church that he doesn't say, at least to my knowledge, to any other church in the New Testament. If you're giving grades, A, B, C, D, E, no, F, A, B, C, D, F. I turned my F into excellent so that I could deal with it. You're going to give the Thessalonian church an A. This is the only church I know about in the New Testament that's going to get an A, because this is the only church that Paul's going to reflect on like this. And I'm just going to give you some highlights to really motivate your interest in the pattern he employed to accomplish these realities. He writes to this church, and he says in verse 6, chapter 1, "You became imitators of us and of the Lord, having received the word in much tribulation with the joy of the Holy Spirit." So they were teachable receivers despite obstacles. "So that you became an example to the believers in Macedonia and Achaia." They were noble imitators. They were leaders by example. Verse 8, "For the word of the Lord has sounded forth from you, not only in Macedonia," where they were, northern Greece, "and Achaia," southern Greece, where Corinth was, "but also," watch this, "in every place your faith toward God has gone forth." Now watch this last clause. "So that we have no need to say anything." Now Bob, here's a question for you. Wouldn't you like to get to your church one Sunday and say, "Hey, you're doing it. I don't have anything to say. You're living it." How would you like to walk into your home or be engaged in your sphere of influence and know that the people that you're investing your life in, you don't have anything else to say? You've said it, they're employing it, they're doing it, it's proclaimed everywhere. I'd call that an A, wouldn't you? I have nothing else to say. And then he goes on to communicate, "For they themselves," that's the people who hear the report, "for they themselves report about us what kind of a reception we had with you," and watch this, "and how you turned to God from idols to serve a living and true God and to wait for his Son from heaven, whom he raised from the dead, that is Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come." So these are teachable receivers, noble imitators, missional proclaimers, and transformed worshipers. I have nothing else to say. Turn over to chapter 4 and we'll just punctuate this one more time. Finally then, verse 1, chapter 4, brethren, Paul writes, we request, we exhort you in the Lord Jesus that as you receive from us instruction as to how you ought to walk and please God. So that's how he was investing his life. Here's how to walk. Here's how to please God. Now look at this parenthetical. Just as you actually do walk. So the only thing left I have to say is do more of it so that you may excel still more. He says of this church at the end of chapter 2, referring to this group of people, for who is our hope or joy or crown of exaltation? Is it not even you? In the presence of our Lord Jesus Christ that is coming, for you are our glory and our joy. You're our prize. You're our trophy. You're our crown. You're the basis of our joy, because someday we will stand before the King of everything. And the presentation that matters, that rejoices my heart and magnifies my exaltation, is you. The product of my life invested through the Spirit, by the Spirit of God, through the Word of God, you are our joy, our crown, our trophy. The end of days when Christ returns, you're what matters. I have no greater joy, if John were talking, than that my children walk in the truth. This is a great church. Don't you want to know what he did to do that? What is the pattern that he followed? Well, thankfully, he tells us. Chapter 2. I'm going to give you 10 primary priorities to pursue to promote God's glory in the life of your family or your church or your ministry. This is how to productively promote Christ in the ways that result in these benefits that Paul has just communicated for our encouragement. I'm going to give you 10 life-changing impact ingredients. Here we go. Verse 1. We're going to do highlights because of the time. We're going to cover the first 12 verses and we're going to dig in, and I'll give you broad brush strokes. For you yourselves know, brethren, that our coming to you was not in vain. In other words, it was productive. We just saw that. It was fruitful. But after we had already suffered and been mistreated in Philippi, as you know, we had the boldness in our God to speak to you the gospel of God amid much opposition. And if you were going to take a point out of verse 2, you would say there's courageous intention despite opposition. That's not one of the 10. I would just note that. Because I think, gentlemen, some of you are going to attempt to influence and invest in categories or in contexts that are not welcoming. Sometimes you're going to be rejected. Sometimes your own children are not going to want to hear what you're saying, and you're going to endure challenges, potential loss. And he said, look, I came boldly in God, and I spoke even though there was opposition. Verse 3, for our exhortation does not come from error or impurity or by way of deceit. Let me give you a couple of prerequisite thoughts. The first thing is, if you're going to influence anybody, your heart needs to be motivated rightly. It needs to be a pure heart. It needs to be motivated, look at verse 3, not from error, not from inaccuracy or impurity or by way of deceit. It's not manipulative. Look how he defines that, verse 4. But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God, who examines our heart. Now think with me for a minute. Here's my pure motive. First of all, to tell you the truth accurately and not to manipulate you so that I receive affirmation from you, but rather that God gets affirmation, because what's done is done for His glory. This is about Him, not me. I'm not doing this to please you so that you'll like me. I'm not doing this to please you so that you'll give your stuff to me. I'm not doing this so you'll elevate me. I'm doing this to honor God. This is about God, not you. And here's the point I want to make, and this is all in the prerequisite category. This is the attitude, the internal motivations. When you minister, when you invest your life, it needs to be for God first. This is not so your children will be a good reputation to the family name. So many of us in ministry, our children become showcases for our reputation. When you invest in people, it needs to be for God first, and it needs to be for them second, not for you. It needs to be about Him, not you. It needs to be about them, not you. Watch what he goes on to say. God who examines our heart, verse 5, for we never came with flattering speech. In other words, to inflate your view of us. We didn't tell you what you wanted to hear so you would think highly of us, as you know, nor with a pretext for greed. In other words, we didn't want your stuff. God is witness. We didn't do this to get something from you. Nor did we seek glory from men, either from you or from others. Do you see what he's saying? What I'm doing is for him, not you. It's for you, not me. It's not to get you to like me. It's not to get you to give stuff to me. It's not to get you to elevate me. It's not about me. It's about you. It's not about you. It's about him. That's motivation. So what we're going to talk about today needs to be driven by that heart, that pure heart, that transparent, authentic heart for him, for them, not you. Number two, prerequisite. I'm going to give you a couple at the gate. So this is not the 10. I could have called 13, but I didn't. These are the prerequisites. These are the things that have to be true when you apply this pathway. If your motive is wrong, the influence, impact, actions you take are irrelevant. Children sniff that out. People sniff that out. If they smell the odor is the right word, not fragrance. If they smell the odor that this is about you, not them, they're not interested. There's a second prerequisite, and that is that what we're going to talk about is to be done not only purely, but relationally. This is a big point, but it's not one of the ten. Watch what verse 6 says at the end. Even though, as apostles of Christ, we might have asserted our authority. So we have position, we have authority, we're apostles. It is valuable, it is acceptable to exercise our positional authority. But notice the first word in verse 7. But. Adversative conjunction, which means on the other hand. We could have legitimately asserted our authority, our weight as apostles, our positional force, but we didn't. Verse 7, but we proved to be gentle among you as a nursing mother tenderly cares for her own children, having thus fond affection for you. We were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives because you have become very dear to us. You know what that is? That's relational language. We were like a mother. We were like a tender mother. We were like a loving mother. We were relational. We could have been forceful with our authority. We chose not to be. Not because it's not legitimate and fair. Sometimes you have to exercise the force of your positional authority. But he chose relational ministry. And here's my point. I want you to hear it. The force of positional authority is not as impactful as relational ministry. The force of positional authority. I'm a father. I am the head of my home. That's non-negotiable. It's appointed by God. It's a fact. But if I default to my authority, I may exchange a greater influence, because positional authority does not impact like relational ministry. How do I know that? Because Paul said I could have, but I didn't. Isn't that interesting? And I find in my life it's easy to default to my position. Just know this, when you're doing that, there's probably less impact. Because the greatest impact is not the force of my position, it's the impact of my relational ministry. So, gentlemen, what we're going to talk about, these 10 things, purely and relationally. Thirdly, consistently. I want you to watch these words. Verse 1, for you yourselves know. Verse 2, as you know. Verse 5, as you know. Verse 9, for you recall. Verse 10, you are witnesses. Verse 11, just as you know. Now, I do have the New American Standard. I don't know how your translation reads, but there's an important verb in verse 7. We proved to be. How many of you have proved in your Bible? You should. Okay, and let me tell you, because we demonstrated. It's in the Greek language, one of the tenses is an aorist tense. An aorist means it happened. Okay, it doesn't tell you about when it happened, just it happened. All right, but this is called a collective historical aorist. An aorist means it happened. Historical means it happened in the past. Collective means like a series of snapshots were taken over and over and over and over. And if you took all of those collective historical snapshots of events in the past and put them all together, you would have an album with a theme, we proved to be. And you know it. You saw it over and over and over and over. Here's the bottom line. Whatever he was doing, he was consistently doing it. He was doing it so often, so consistently, collectively, historically, over time, that it was undeniable. He didn't have to make a case. They knew it was true because they had witnessed it over and over. Gentlemen, you can leave retreats like this. You can be cranked up and inspired. You can say, you know, I'm going to love her like I ought to love her. I ought to value her like I want to value her. You can implement these 10 things and you do it like a New Year's resolution for a month. That's not impactful. It's not a spasm of inspiration. It's a resolve of a committed lifestyle consistently over time, historically, collected together, creating a weight of influence, not by your position, but by the relational way you engage, purely from the heart, for their benefit, to the glory of God, consistently in your life, pursuing these patterns. That's how they got to where they got. He lived it over and over and over. Gentlemen, I want to encourage you that if you're going to adopt this paradigm, keep doing it. You probably didn't get to where you are overnight, and you're not going to have an impact tomorrow, but you'll have it over time as you employ consistently, purely this pursuit relationally, impacting the people you love and care about. So these are the three perspectives, prerequisites, things you do purely, relationally, and consistently. And if I'm going to add one word, and also dependently, it's Christ in you. It's the power of God, not your self-help, that is going to make the life-changing impact difference. So as one commissioned by God, like Paul, if you're a father, you're commissioned by God, and examined by God based on that stewardship someday, here are the 10 things you need to do to produce this kind of lasting fruit. We together so far? You okay? All right, here we go. 10. Number 1. Top 10 life-changing impact ingredients. Number 1, pray for them constantly. Now, that is not in the text. It is in the letter. Look at verse 2. We give thanks to God always for all of you, clarifying statement, making mention of you in our prayers, constantly bearing in mind your work of faith. So we're going to talk about their testimony. The thing that I want to highlight is, always for all of you, making mention of you in our prayers, you're constantly on our mind. Look at Philippians chapter 1, just a few pages to the left. This is Paul's pattern to anybody he disciples, anybody he influences. Verse 3, chapter 1, Philippians. I thank my God in all my remembrance of you, always offering prayer with joy in my every prayer for you all. Colossians chapter 1, we give thanks, verse 3, to God, the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, praying always for you. And then this kicker statement in chapter 4 of Colossians, verse 2, devote yourselves to prayer. The greatest ministry impact influence you can have is to pray constantly for the people you want to influence. Daily, consistently, constantly. The work is God's work, and your first work is to pray for the people you want to impact. I'm going to give you a way to pray. We use it at our church. I want to pass it on. It's so helpful. It's called the Bless Acrostic. Bless. You can pray this for your neighbors. You can pray this for your children. You can pray this for your spouse. It's an acrostic. Bless. Bless them in prayer. B, pray for their body. Pray for their health. Pray for their physical life. What happens in your body affects your life. My son's illness affects his spiritual life. It's challenging. Pray for their body. L, pray for their labor, their work. If they're a student, pray for them as a student. That's work. Pray for their labor, their work, their job. 3, pray for their emotional health, the stability, their emotional victory, their emotional stability, their emotional joy. Pray that they're emotionally sound, healthy. S, pray for their social life, their marriage, their friendships, their relationships, their engagements with people. Body, labor, emotions, social life. Pray for their spiritual life. Pray that they'll engage God. They'll be spiritually alive. They'll be spiritually alert. They'll be spiritually submissive. Pray for them spiritually. That's a great way to pray. Pray for them constantly. Ask God to be at work in their life. It is the first foundational cornerstone. Paul said, I constantly am calling your name to God. Number 2, be with them. Physically, and I'm going to add the word presently, because you can be with someone physically and not be present, especially in a techno age where you have a cell phone or some other tool, or the large screen is on in the other room and something important is happening in your mind. Somebody's going to score and you've got to see it. You can be physically present, but not be present. I want to point out a little nugget in verse 7. We prove to be what? Gentle among you. Among you. That Greek phrase, en meso, means in the midst of you. It's used of Jesus when he was left behind. Remember, his parents left town. He was 12. They're headed back to Nazareth. They're looking in the group and they can't find their son. So they come back to town looking for Jesus. Remember, they find him in the temple with the leaders, religious leaders, and he's sitting in their midst. Okay, same phrase. Listening and answering questions. Listening and asking questions. Where two or three are gathered together, there I am in their midst. Gentlemen, don't miss this. True influence, Paul says, is what I prove to be by me being in your midst. I am where you are. I'm engaged in your life. I'm involved with your world. I've not invited you to my office. I've not invited you to the coffee shop. I'm in your world. Here's a key part of influence. You go to where the people you want to invest in live, work, play, sleep. My daughter, who's 7 years older than my son, as a father, I would go up and sit in her room. I'd look at her pictures, I'd talk about her things, I'd listen to her music in her midst. Hey, Wendy, how are you doing? What happened at school today? Not her coming into my world trying to gain access to me, but me in her world investing in her. The second ingredient, Paul says, is I prove to be gentle among you, in your midst. Physically present. Head up. Eyes open. Ears alert. Engaged. Present. Not absent. And this is Luke 2:46. Jesus was found sitting in the midst of the teachers, listening and asking questions. I think that's a great verb, just a metaphor, picture of what it means to be in the midst of someone, engaged in their life. Number three. Number one, pray for them constantly. Number two, be with them physically and presently. Number three, care for them gently. Now, this is vivid language. We prove to be gentle. It means soft, mild, not harsh. The antonym is harsh, gruff. And then, as if you don't understand it, he's going to give an undeniable illustration of how gentle. What do I mean by that? I'm as gentle as a nursing mother, not a surrogate, not a daycare worker, a nursing mother who tenderly cares for her own children. So here is a vivid example of what it means to be an impact player relationally. There is a quality about your encounter that is other oriented, sensitive, soft, gentle, adapting to the needs of the other person. I mean, nursing mother. Gentle, patient, kind, all about the other person. You cannot envision a nursing mother going, "Stop it, you should know better by now. I've taught you. Get a hold of it." You cannot imagine a nursing mother losing her patience. She's a nursing mother. It's a baby. When you invest, understand you're dealing with people who are precious, who may not understand what they need to understand. They may not get it the first time. It may take them multiple times. Gentlemen, be gentle, like a nursing mother. And then it goes on to say, who tenderly cares for her own children. The word tender care means to warm. It's only used what husbands are supposed to cherish their wives, nourish, cherish. It's only used there, Ephesians 5. It's used of a mother hen who's gathering her chicks and warming them. Caring for them, protecting them. To be an impact player, you need to care for the people you're investing in gently and tenderly. Not because of your weakness are you gentle, but because of theirs. Now, I know what you're thinking, man. If I don't raise my voice, I can't get their attention. Listen to Proverbs 25:15. A gentle tongue can break a bone. I want to give you some hints on being gentle. And I said this to you, I think, yesterday about avoiding harshness. Don't ever be harsh with her. Frankly, anybody you want to invest in and influence, you need to be gentle with. And you don't need to be hard. You don't need to be loud. You do not need to make your brow furrow. Because 60% of communication is nonverbal. You know that, right? So what I look like is more powerful than what comes out of my mouth. Here's some hints for being gentle and avoiding harshness. Number one, be spiritual. Do your devotion. Spend time with God. Gentleness and meekness is a fruit of the Spirit. I can't get up in the morning and go, I'm going to be gentle and patient today. Anybody tried that? Does it work? It doesn't work. But if you meet with God, you have margin. Number two, remember that you're dealing with people, people made in the image of God. Deal with them with dignity. You could be 5 years old. They're still a human being made in the image of God. They're learning. They're a person. Treat them with dignity. I'll tell you what, this bugs me as a pastor, how sometimes children's workers talk to children. Children are people. Youth, young adults, yeah, they may act out. They may be in the midst of some serious life changes. They're still people. Treat them with dignity. Thirdly, deal with things early. I think when you're dealing with people and you're investing in and you let stuff go too long, especially with children, and you discipline out of anger, it's destructive, not instructive. You know, the word discipline means instruction. You're not instructing anybody if you're doing it out of anger. Never discipline out of anger. Deal with it early so you don't get frustrated. And fourthly, if you can't deal with it gently, hand off to somebody who can. As a parent, I think one of the greatest decisions my wife and I made was if one of us was frustrated, and that could happen, right? We're human beings. Kids can do things over and over, and you lose your way. She's with them all day. I get home. She's at the end of herself. Well, we're a tag team partnership. I'm not exercised. I can handle it. Or if I can't handle it, I tag team her, she handles it. So a fourth thing is if you can't be gentle, tag somebody who can. Otherwise, don't deal with it. Care for them gently. You guys know I ride motorcycles, and two years now, I had a very unglamorous motorcycle event. It's hard to even tell this story without shaming myself, but I've ridden all my life, and I was in Birmingham going to the hospital with my son to do a blood test, and my son and wife met me at the hospital, and I was pulling in on my motorcycle to the parking deck, and I was going 3-4 miles an hour turning into my slot, and I've ridden all my life. I'm on a high-performance motorcycle. I'm doing 3 miles an hour. I'm turning into the slot, and the lady who I was parking beside threw her door open just as I was turning in. Now, she wouldn't have hit me, but she scared me. And I did something you shouldn't do. I grabbed the right front caliper, which is your big binders up front. And on a performance bike, that means you don't stop in an inch or two. You stop now. Well, stop now, 3 miles an hour, leaned over. You see what's going to happen? That's what happens. So it started to go. I got my foot off the peg. I'm somewhere here. It's not that heavy, but it's too heavy. I'm not going to make it. I can't hold it. All the adrenaline's not going to get me home. So I decide, second dumb decision, was I'm going to go down with it. Okay? I don't want to bend up my mirrors, break my mirrors. I don't want to dig up my saddlebag. So I'll just cushion it. Bad decision. You'd be amazed at what force can be generated this far from the ground with the weight of the bike and the weight of the man on a concrete parking deck. When I hit the ground, I knew, and I played football in college. I've been hit. I was a wide receiver, and I've had people clean. I've never felt that. This shoulder gave way. I knew it was bad. I felt it. Now, I was full of adrenaline. I was embarrassed, so I hopped up and picked the bike up and put it on the stand. I looked it over, realized that nothing was broken except my shoulder. I started to turn white. I started to lose my way. I walked to the office where my son was. My wife says, "What in the world happened to you?" I said, "I had an accident." She said, "I'm so sorry." I didn't even hardly stop. Went right straight to the ER. That was the good news. I was already at the hospital. Severe separation of the AC joint 3. I've got a Kevlar strap and some screws. 3 miles an hour, very unglamorous, lots of pain. One of the best, you know, Andrew's Orthopedics in Birmingham, he does Drew Brees and all those high-end athletes. His protege did this shoulder, and frankly, if it wasn't him, it may not even be functional. But here's what happens after surgery. They call it physical therapy, PT, but really stands for physical terrorism. Okay, any you do I have a witness? Yeah. Yeah, I think those people have something wrong with them. They get some kind of strange joy out of watching pain. But anyway, it was 8 weeks of that. Now, if you've ever injured a shoulder, shoulders are painful. There were two certified PT specialists, Rachel and Joe. They were equally certified. They were equally competent. Joe worked on me the first day, and I wanted to hurt Joe. Because Joe was hurting me, but he told me it was good for me. And if they didn't break it loose, they were going to have to go back in and do it again. And I didn't want that, so I endured it. The second time in, I got Rachel. I liked Rachel. She talked soft to me. How's that feel? Let's go a little further. We can get a little. No, Joe, it was all about. Rachel was soft. She was gentle. She was caring. They did the exact same thing, but when I went in, guess who I wanted? Rachel. It's not because Joe couldn't do the same thing. I just didn't want him to do it. You say, what does this have to do with anything? There's a reason you want to care for them gently. Because you may do the right thing, they just may not want you to do it. Because of the way you're doing it, not because of what you're doing. I needed help. But I wanted one of them to do it because of the way they did it. Gentlemen, I just want to plant a seed and say this. How you do what you do is as important as what you do. I did it caring gently like a nursing mother. Soft, tone, voice, touch. Number four. Love them passionately. If I were going to rephrase this, I'd say pursue them passionately. Having thus, only time this word is used in the New Testament, you're going to see it right here. Having thus fond affection. It's used in a Lyconium grave inscription of a parent standing by the grave of a dead child, longing and calling for him to return, wanting a reunion, a reconnection. It's used of the affection you can feel. It's pathos that pursues. It motivates and moves. I don't have time to describe it all, but let me summarize it this way. The people you want to impact need to know you love them because of what they sense from you when you're engaging them. Not just your words. In the South, we're big on words. I mean, we tell everybody we love everybody. Okay, God bless you. We love you, you know. Let me just keep moving. I don't need to explain that. I'm just going to say that. You can say words without the heart behind the words. This is, you know, you saw, you felt. We had a pursuing passion that you could see and feel. You didn't have to hear it. You felt it. You ever lost a child? I have. Got up on a Sunday morning. I had a 2-year-old daughter, our first. Karen comes down and says, hey, where's Wendy? I don't know, where's Wendy? Wendy's gone. Well, that's a bad feeling. Our dog is gone, Labrador Retriever, and our 2-year-old daughter. Can't find them, not in the house. We're in Alabaster, Alabama. Behind our house was a creek. All I could think of, black labs, love water. She's gone to the water with the dog. He's taken her there. It's going to be bad. Now, gentlemen, I didn't put boots on. I didn't put waders on. I didn't care. I went from my home to the creek and all, you know, snake. It didn't matter. I was looking for a little girl because there was something beating in my heart that didn't care. I was pursuing passionately someone I loved and cared about. Thankfully, she wasn't there. I drove up and down the streets. I went everywhere I knew to go. I could not find my daughter or my dog. I got home. We're beginning to do the let's call the authorities thing. And a neighbor calls and said, hey, do you have a black dog and a little girl? They're sitting on my porch on the porch swing, a block and a half away. Now, I love that. I love that phone call. But I hated the feelings that preceded it. But they describe fond affection. I'm pursuing passionately somebody I love. It is an I will not be denied pursuit. Let me tell you, those of you that want to invest in people in an impact way, there's got to be a passion in you that pursues people and those you care about because you care about them. It's a do whatever it takes pursuit. It's a fond affection that they can feel, see, and understand whether you ever verbalize it or not. And I'm an advocate of telling your children you love them. But you need to show them you love them by the way you pursue them. You say, you don't know my child. I just know what your child's worth. Number five. So we have pray for them constantly, be with them physically and presently, care for them gently, love them or pursue them passionately, and share with them spiritually and personally. I love this. Look at what Paul says in verse 8. Because he had this kind of pursuing passion for them, he was well pleased, a word which means he delighted in. He was determined to. It's a twin word. It has two nuances. One is, it brings me joy and I want to. And two, I will. I'm determined to. I was well pleased to impart, metadidomi, to share, to give something of what I had to you. And notice this, not only the gospel of God. The implication is, if you're going to be an investor, you got to tell them the gospel. You have to explain the faith. But notice what else, and I'm going to presume that's a given. You understand that part of your job is to declare the gospel. Verse 2 says, I spoke boldly to you the gospel of God. Gentlemen, you ought to be a vehicle of a witness, a gospel witness to your children or anybody you're investing in. Don't presume it, tell it, and share it. But the point that I want to make is what else he says. I not only gave you the gospel of God, but also our own psuche, our lives, our soul, because you were so dear to us. Share with them spiritually your faith. And share with them your life. When Paul says, I shared my own life, he's saying, I shared my own soul. I was transparent. I was open. I wasn't just the preacher. I wasn't just the apostle. I was the man who shared my life with you. The people that have had the greatest impact on me are the people that have been transparently honest with me. They've taken down the mask of position and they've shared heart to heart. Paul said, I did not just give you the gospel. I went heart to heart with you. I went soul to soul with you. You got me, not a facade of me. You got the gospel from me, and you get my life, my passion, my thoughts, my reality. Share with them spiritually and personally. Take delight in that. Share what means the most to you. And the thing that means to most to us all, the gospel, the faith generally, the gospel specifically, and your life personally. That's five. Are you with me so far? Okay, that's five of them. All right, we're going to make a difference. Number six, sweat for them sacrificially. Verse 9, for you we recall, brethren, our labor, that's toil, sweat, that's working hard. Hardship is suffering. We sacrifice. It hurt. We did it anyway. For you recall, brethren, our labor and hardship, how working night and day, tirelessly, so as not to be a burden to any of you, we proclaim to you the gospel of God. Gentlemen, I'm going to summarize this way. Give your life away. This is Paul saying, I paid the cost for what I'm giving you. Hey, write down this verse, 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 15. and write down KJV. Now, I love my New American Standard, but I think the KJV does a better job with this verse exegetically. And here's how it sounds. 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 15. It's a great verse for your home, too. It's a great verse for your wife. I do weddings with this verse. It's an awesome verse. My wife cross-stitched it in our first home, and I didn't understand it until I studied it. And it applies to this. Here's the verse. Paul talking to the Corinthians, and this is what he says. I will very gladly spend and be spent for you, though the more abundantly I love you, the less I be loved. I'm going to spend my assets. I'm going to spend myself. And I'm going to keep doing it, even if the doing of it doesn't result in you loving me back. Because I'm not loving you because you love me. I actually think my translation twists it. Because it says, shouldn't you love me more? And the whole point of the context is, he's telling them, the reason you can trust me as an apostle is not just because of the things I've experienced with God, things that I've seen, things that I've done, my enduring suffering, but the nature of my love. I've served you at my own expense. I've expected nothing of you, and I didn't stop doing it even though you didn't reciprocate. Can you see how good that would be in your home? Honey, I'm going to love you. I'm going to spend and be spent for you, though the more abundantly I love you, the less I'd be loved. Man, there's a motto for your house. There's also a motto for you as a servant who wants to impact people. Give your life away. I worked night and day so you didn't have to. I labored. I sweat. The word labor is toil. I suffered hardship. This was hurtful to me. I was the sacrificer. I was the toiler. I did it night and day so that you could get the gospel, so that you could advance and grow at no expense. That's a powerful influence. Sweat for them sacrificially. Number 7. Show them. Show them sincerely. You could say, show them authentically. You could show them honorably, which means not hypocritically or legalistically. Watch what he says in verse 10. You are witnesses, and so is God. So it's sincere, it's authentic, it's not fabricated or facade. Three words, how devoutly. Hosios means holy. It means the burning heart. It has to do with passion for God. You saw our devotion. You saw our passion toward God. And how uprightly, that's dikios, it means right behavior. It's applying what you know. It's conforming to the commandments before God. So I have a heart for God. I'm demonstrating submission to God. I'm upright. I'm applying it. I'm not just saying it. I'm not just being passionate. I'm living it towards God. And then the word blamelessly has to do with above reproach toward others, humanity. So you've got this heart for God, submission to God in obedience, and you've got this exemplary example before men. In other words, you're the real deal. If you want to use one word, you have integrity. You have credibility. Now, here's an observation. If you have children who have not witnessed the transformation of your life because of the gospel, your children are at risk. Because first-generation Christians, they change. Children of those Christians witness that transformation. And they're convinced by the observation that the gospel message is real. They've seen it change their parents. But if your children don't see the transformation, they're at risk because it's words without reality unless you display a life-giving confirmation, validation that what you're saying about God is really true about God. One of the worst things you can do as a parent or as an influencer is to be religious and not real. to say the words but don't live the life, to say God's important but don't have any passion for Him. Everything else is important but God. And then to know what you know and then not apply it in obedience to God. And then cut deals that are sideways in the world where you don't have a reputation that is blameless before men. I just bought a car in California and my wife had a pickup truck and we sold it and we bought a vehicle and it was a used vehicle and we went to get it in Santa Monica and the guy we bought it from when we were doing the title exchange, he said, look, I'm going to write down $10,000 less than you're paying me for it. Actually, $11,000 less. And he said, that way you don't have to pay tax on the $11,000. You can pay tax on this number as opposed to what you're going to pay me. I'm going to help you out. Now look, I have trouble with California. They want my money any way they can get it. Okay? I mean, it's not right. It is not right. Okay, that car has already had tax paid on it. It's a used car. Now I'm going to get to do it again. But I've got my 20-year-old son standing with me. So what do? Save the tax? You know the right answer. You got to do what you say is right to do. And you also get to say it to a guy who thinks he's helping you out to say, you know what? I can't do that. I totally understand that you're trying to help me. But A, I'm a Christian. B, I'm in the ministry. And the last thing I want that my son to know is that I'm going to compromise on this in that way. Now look, I'm not a holier-than-thou person. I'm a Christian. So are you. Act like it and live like it. Don't just say it. Do it. Because if you want influence, you got to live it. Anybody like to follow a hypocrite? Does anybody follow a hypocrite? Not unless they pay them to follow them. That's probably politics right there, right? You know? Anyway, we won't start down that. Some one of you really likes to talk about that. Show them. Here's all that Paul's saying. You saw the credibility of my testimony, my integrity. You saw my heart, my devotion. You saw my obedience and submission. And you saw its application before men. You know I was blameless. Therefore, I have credibility. Influencers have credibility. Hey, listen, let me say this. Sometimes you'll lose it too. Own it. Every decision I make is not the right one. But when you make a wrong one and the Spirit of God convicts you, deal with it. I did the wrong thing. I shouldn't have done that. Forgive me. Fix it. Make restitution. Do the right thing. A good name is to be preferred above great riches. It is precious beyond rubies. Show them authentically. Show them honorably. Show them sincerely. Not hypocritically, not legalistically. God forbid that you're a facade where you say the religious speak, you do the legalistic behavior, but you've got no heart in it. All right, now here are a triad of tools. We're wrapping up. 8, 9, and 10. These are things that you do. These are the tools in your tool bag. I could actually argue that everything we just said is how you do it. This is what you do. We just talked about who you are. Now we're going to talk about what you do. And before I do that, let me just highlight something. Verse 11, which says this. There's three Greek verbs here. Just as you know how we were exhorting, encouraging, and imploring. Now, you want to circle the word each one of you. Okay, you want to circle the word each if you write in your Bible. There's an upside to that because you highlight things. Downside, as you get old, you can't read what God said versus what you've circled or written. The word each is important because it says, I adapted my approach to you based on each single one of you. There is a personalized quality toward your leadership and investing influence. Each one equals uniquely and individually. Each one means I did these things. uniquely based on who you are, individually based on what you needed. There's a place for corporate and collective, but there's also a place for individualized and unique. Each of your children are different. What one will respond to, another one won't. The kind of thing that motivates one won't motivate the other. The kind of language that helps one won't help the other. My son and my daughter couldn't be more different. He's very linear. She's mosaic. She's a feeler. She's a mercy shower. She has certain kinds of personality. And frankly, she's a woman. So learning how to relate to her uniquely, to lead her, to influence her, is individualized for her. Write this down, uniquelyyou.com. Uniquelyyou.com. Trust me, I'm not in any pyramid thing. I'm selling nothing. Okay? This has been very helpful to me. My staff did this. My family did this. Anybody, every couple I marry, I ask them to do this. It is not perfect. It's not the Bible. It's not inspired. It's a survey that ultimately displays at the end a report which says, this is your personality type and these are your spiritual gifts. Based on this test, in my experience, it is very helpful. It helps me understand me, the way God made me. It helps me understand what God gave me. It helps me understand the woman that God gave me and the children that He gave me. I know I'm a D, which is a type A in some things. I'm going to be more directive, more dominant, more decisive. That, you get that personality. That's mine. My daughter is an S. She's a responder, a supporter. She's soft. She's passive relationally. And she's a mercy shower in terms of her spiritual gifts. When I'm dealing with my daughter as a D, I've got to amp everything way down. If I'm Jeff running the soundboard, the sound is going way, way down. The tone is soft. I'm asking questions, not giving directives. Because Wendy responds to that kind of a leader, not a D. When you're dealing with people, you got to know who you're dealing with because you're dealing with them individually and uniquely. You know how we led each one of you. If you understand that, would you say amen? Now, you go on that website, you can find your own, and maybe, Bob, you know a better one. I just find it incredibly helpful in terms of leading and influence people if I understand their love language, their personality, and their spiritual gifts. If you want to lead and invest in people, you'll understand them. And besides, 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 7 says, live with your wife in an understanding way. That helps me. I was 20 years in before I found that test, took it, and went, oh my goodness. I now get it. And I had my children take it. And if you come to my house, we talk that language. Dad's being a D. Dad, relax. And so we talk to each other, and that's very helpful in terms of ministry and influence and relationship. And you may have already done that. You may have been more insightful than me, but that's a great tool that I've used, each one uniquely and individually, and that test and tool helps me know how to respond. All right, here are the three tools, three Greek verbs, three things to do. Just as you know how we were, these are all present, active, and indicatives are explaining an activity that's habitual and regular. Number one is exhorting, which means lead them believably. Challenge them convincingly. It's one tool. I just couldn't figure out which was the best way to say it. So I'm giving you both. Couldn't make a decision, so I'm giving you both. Lead them believably. Challenge them convincingly. The word is parakaleo. You hear it as a comforter. It's often translated comforter. Kaleo, to call, para, alongside. It's a word which means to call someone to you, or it means to come alongside of someone, like the comforter, the Holy Spirit, who is to support you. It can go either way. It either means to lead them by calling them to where you are, or it means to come to them, to be called to their side, to comfort them. The next word undeniably means comfort. So I'm going to argue that the force and the nuance of the first verb is not to comfort, but to challenge. To call them to where you are. to call them to your side, to exhort, to implore, to urge. It's all over the book of 1 Thessalonians. I urge you, I exhort you. It's the word exhortation. But it's the exhortation that says, come to where I am. Some of us lead from behind. We don't get out in front. We push. Influencers who invest and impact are men who get out in front and say, come to where I am. Do what I'm doing. Apply what you're seeing. Challenge them. Summer and a half ago, I weighed 245. I'm 195 today. It's a little bit different. I have genes that make me an easy keeper. There's a famine in the land, I'm going to survive. It takes very little to keep me going. My dad, when he passed away, was 348. I am the smallest male walls I know. I am determined to be fit. And I thought I was okay at 245. Right? I'm still 100 less than my dad. But with my family's illness, I began to realize, you know, I got to maximize my fitness because I can't keep up. I'm in ministry. I'm a caregiver. I'm tired. And so I began to do nutrition and da-da-da-da-da and you get fit. And I learned that 70% of fitness is nutrition, what you eat. 20% of nutrition or fitness is exercise. And the rest is supplements. That's what I discovered. And I began to apply it. And then I discovered this particular deal where, well, because my wife can't do exercise because of her illness, she wanted a way to maintain her fitness. And I discovered these drops, and I'm not selling this either, okay? I met a lady in the, naturopathic world, which is a little voodoo, but it seems to work. She lost 55 pounds and she was sedentary, which means she was not mobile or exercising. She sat in a chair all day long, 10 hours a day, and she lost 45 pounds. I said, Kristen, how in the world did you do it? And she said, well, there's these drops that have an amino chain in them that pregnant women make a hormone for when they're pregnant. It's because they get sick and they don't eat, but they have to build a baby and they have to stay healthy. And this hormone that God gave them goes and finds stored resources when they're undernourished and they don't die. Their baby is healthy. They're healthy because they go get stored assets. And these drops, that's what they do. And there's a metabolic stimulator in there and there's an appetite suppressor in there. And you take 10 drops 3 to 6 times a day. You eat 500 calories, which is starvation. Okay. But you're not hungry because of the drops. And when your body, and you want your metabolism to work, you didn't know this was a nutritional seminar, but you want your body to work because you don't want your intestinal tract to shut down, but you're depriving your body so it thinks starvation, so it's going to find stored resources, and guess what it goes to find? Stored fat. Well, who wants to get rid of stored fat? Me. I do. Okay? So I go, really? Well, I'll try anything one time, mostly. If it's offered to me from a credible source, she was. So I bought my little two droplet bottles, did my routine. It's a 24 to 44 day kind of a deal. Very strict. It's a 50-year-old diet. It's not new. It's just back in the day you had to have injections. Now you can do it with these little drops under your tongue. 244, pound a day, 30 days. Yeah, I know. I'm really not selling anything. I have no connection to the company at all. And this is an illustration, okay? It's HCG2, Cincinnati Health Online, if you want to do it. HCG2. Yeah. What did you learn? Oh, hey, Harry got rich at the conference. He got 10 people underneath of him, and he's making a bazillion. Yeah. I don't sell anything. I promote the gospel. I'm in nobody's chain except Christ, okay? so I'm not going to get wealthy. But here's the point of my illustration, HCG2, okay? Cincinnati Health Online, they'll ship it for free, two bottles, $39 a bottle, $78 to your door. Now, it's not easy, because 500 calories a day is not easy. You sniff food, you do 500 calories. You walk by that buffet, you got 500 calories today. So it's not easy, but it works. Pound a day, I did 31 pounds in the first 30 days. Now, here's what happened, and this is the point of the illustration. I didn't tell anybody but my wife I was doing it. But people saw something. I changed. I applied something nutritionally that resulted in vice president of the Fat Boy Club over here to fit. In 30 days, and my church people were going, hey, what are you doing? Can I do it too? Now, I probably should have gotten in the chain if there is one. I didn't promote anything. I just lived something. Gentlemen, if you will apply what it is you want the people that you want to influence, if they watch it in you, you're calling them to you. You can do this too. I have family members that have done this now. My daughter's done it. My sister's done it. Because they see it in me and I can say, yeah, come on, you can do this. I'll coach you. I'll give you the little hints and I'll help you get where I am. Do you see? Now apply that spiritually. I'm walking with God. Imagine this. I have a heart for God. I'm submitted to God. I'm living honorably before men. I'm tracking. I'm memorizing. I'm sharing my faith. I'm loving my... Hey, come on, you can do this too. You think anybody might follow? Sure they will. Because you're challenging them by the life you're living, not just the words you're saying. And you're calling them to where you are. Come on, you can do this. Everybody needs to be coached and inspired. And that's what this is. Lead them believably, challenge them convincingly, because you're living it obviously. This is call them by getting out in front, or lead them rather, by getting out in front and calling them to where you are. That's your first tool. Second tool, encourage them regularly or encourage them verbally. This particular word means to speak and to comfort. It's to say words that encourage. This is to encourage someone so they don't quit and comfort them so they don't despair. This is support them emotionally in the journey that is pursuing God spiritually and practically. Being a Christian is not a smooth ride. It means to cheer them up. Muthos is story. Para is tell them a story. Come alongside of them with an encouraging word. It means it's a word, the lexicon says, which addresses the feelings rather than the head. It is motivational. It's encouragement. It's used of consolation. It was used when Alexander the Great was depressed. People would encourage and support him. This is learning the art of helping somebody continue. Somebody who's faint-hearted, somebody who's discouraged, somebody who's weary in the way. The word faint-hearted means little of heart. They're tired, they're weary, they want to give up, and you come alongside and say, hey, Ron, you can do this. You can do this. Come on, keep going. Chuck Swindoll tells a great story. Do you know the name Ignace Jan Paderewski? Do you know him as a musician? He's a world-class pianist. Ignace Jan Paderewski. I may be abusing his name. Okay, if you like that better, that's good. I'm saying it the way I heard it, but say it again. What is Paderewski? Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Carnegie Hall. Place is packed. Concert's about to start. Ebony Grand on the stage. A mother brings her son who's learning to play the piano as a means to inspiring him to pursue the discipline to be a pianist. The place, people are talking, it's a black suit, tie affair, high-end, Carnegie Hall, big night. Wife is talking to some other patrons who can't wait till Paderewski comes out, or Paderewski. She looks over and her son is not in his seat. He's 10. Where did he go? The next thing she hears is the crowd going, because a 10-year-old boy is walking across the stage, being seated at the ebony grand piano, the spotlight's on, and he begins to play Chopsticks. Paderewski, I got it right that time, is off stage. He sees what's happening. He comes out on stage, comes behind the boy, and Swindoll tells the story great, comes behind the boy and he plays a counter melody to Chopsticks. And while he's playing, he's speaking into the ear of the little boy, don't quit, don't quit, keep going, come on, don't quit, keep going. That's this word. It's to encourage somebody to keep doing what they ought to be doing or what they're doing already. Stay in it. Keep going. You can do it. That's this word. All right. Invest your life. Don't spend it. Call to somebody to where you are out of the integrity of your life and then encourage them to keep doing the right things they're doing. Come alongside when they fumble and pick them up. Become an encourager, not just an exhorter. Anybody agree with me that being a Christian is a little rough? Have you seen people get discouraged in the way? Come alongside. Now, I have a story now. My family's been six, 7 years. I've learned a little bit about the grace of God in the journey. You'd be shocked at how many opportunities that gives me to say, hey, you can do this. God's good. He does good things out of hard places. His grace is sufficient. He's got power made perfect when you can't. Don't quit. He's faithful. He's true. He's good. You'll become what you're not through this trial. Count it joy because you know that the trying of your faith works patience, and patience, when it's finished, patience, hupomeno, stay under the weight. Keep pushing it because you know that that will make you whole, complete, lacking in nothing. And you need wisdom and God's going to give it. Keep going. Do you feel that? That's your job. You get in their space. You know their world. You call them to where you are. You show them. And you encourage them. You learn their love language. You learn the words that motivate and encourage and support. You get in their world and you deliver that. He does say, look, I do this. You saw this. I called you. I exhorted you. I encouraged. I comforted you. And then this last one. Marta Ruamai. 1 Thessalonians 2, I exhorted, I encouraged, and I implored. Convince them persuasively. Marta Ruamai is where you get the word martyr. It means to bear witness. It means to give a testimony. It means to give a passionate testimony. Anybody ever drive off the highway having fallen asleep besides me? Nobody? I mean, like in the median type drive off the highway. My dad and I left New Jersey at 11 o'clock for Oshkosh, Wisconsin. He's a pilot. I'm a pilot. The world's biggest air show is in Oshkosh every year, the EAA fly-in. We rode. He just came up to me on a Saturday night and said, hey, you want to go to Oshkosh? I'm 18 years old. Sure, let's go to Oshkosh. See the airplanes. We jump in the car. He drives the first shift. This is New Jersey to Wisconsin starting at 11 o'clock at night. My shift began at 2 a.m. Interstate 80, Western Pennsylvania. Harry, you can't turn on the radio. I need to sleep so I can drive. So now it's quiet on Interstate 80, Western Pennsylvania. I got tired. So I rolled the window down, hung my head outside, did all the things you do, blinked my eyes, tired. And then I thought, you know, I'm just going to rest them just a second. You know what that is? That's what an 18-year-old does with no life experience. Okay? Here's an aside, parenthetically. You're getting a lot of extra stuff today. They took 30 over-the-road truckers. They put them in a room with a virtual setup where they were told that they were deprived sleep, and they were told to push a button when they knew they were going to fall asleep, and they were in front of a monitor. Do you know how many of those 30 truckers pushed the button right before they fell asleep? None of them. Here's a fact. You'll never know when you're going to go to sleep. You'll just go to sleep. So I went to sleep, and I woke up to the sound of my father's voice, "Hair!" The grass was over the hood. We were in the median. I got it, Dad. So, and I remember he said, "Hey, don't overcorrect," because that's what you do. You tend to overcorrect. You come out too fast. You hit the asphalt. You have traction, and then you overcorrect the other way, and you end up doing this, and you flip. And it was an interesting recovery, but we survived it. We pulled over. He said, "I'll drive." I said, "Okay." Do you know how much I drove after that? This much. I didn't drive it the rest of that trip. He had it. Here's my point. Anybody who will listen to Harry Walls will hear me say, don't drive tired. It'd be better to pull off and sleep on the highway. It'd be better off to get there late than never. Now, they have 5-hour energy, and they've got these Starbucks shots at the convenience store. So you got no-dose and Vivarin, and I got all those things in my glove box. Here's what I won't do: drive tired. And I'm telling you, don't you drive tired. I have two people in my church who died tired. One drove off the road from Birmingham to Atlanta. He's a major in the military going to Atlanta for an assignment, and he never made it. He drove off the road, hit a tree, father of three, dead. Bob's dead, fell asleep. That can happen to you. Do you hear the way I just told that? That's Marta Ruamai. I lived an experience. I'm telling you with pathos in my voice and passion in my life, don't do what I did. Or I'm saying, do what I've done. So it's a positive or a negative. Sometimes your greatest influence is when you tell somebody what not to do. Hey, don't do what I did. Man, I about killed myself. It's interesting, on that part of Interstate 80, best I can tell, that's the only spot you could pull that off without trees in the median or a concrete abutment. It was just the Lord preserving a life, two lives. Don't drive tired. Gentlemen, call them to where you are. Challenge them convincingly. Comfort them. Encourage them verbally or emotionally. And then finally, convince them persuasively. Invest your life. Don't spend it. And you got your work cut out for you. Right? Let me just read this to you. It's worth the time. Well, I'll be done. It's a cool illustration. You know about the game of life? Anybody play the game of life? You know, the Milton Bradley game of life? In 1798, before Milton Bradley was born, a board game from England arrived in the United States. It became popular. It was called the New Game of Human Life. Acquiring virtues sped you through the game while vices slowed you down. Parents were encouraged to play this game with their children, and the game's main point was life is a voyage that begins at birth, that it ends at death. God is at the helm, fate is cruel, and your reward lies beyond the grave. 1798. The game, the new game of human life. 1860, Milton Bradley invented a simple board game and called it the checkered game of life. The good path included honesty and bravery. The difficult path included idleness and disgrace. Industry and perseverance led to wealth and success. Bradley described it as a highly moral game that encourages children to lead exemplary lives and entertains both old and young with a spirit of friendly competition. 1860. 1960. This is the one I played. The Milton Bradley Company released a commemorative edition called simply The Game of Life. It sold 35 million copies. In this game, you earn money, buy furniture, and have babies. Vices and virtues are non-existent. The winner of the game is the one who at life's day of reckoning makes the most money and retires to millionaire acres. Is that the one you played? That's the one I played. 1990s. Milton Bradley game designers tried to make the game less about money. They emphasized good deeds like saving an endangered species or solving a pollution problem. However, the only reward for these good deeds is cash. And you can earn as much by winning at a reality TV show. 2011, this version. Players can attend school, travel, start a family, or do whatever they want. If they earn enough points, they can reward themselves with a sports car. There is no end or last square to the game. You stop anytime you want. The box says 1,000 ways to live your life. You choose. Values are up for grabs. You get as many points scuba diving as you do for donating a kidney. The description on the website says, do whatever it takes to retire in style with the most wealth at the end of the game. 2011, The Game of Life. We have our work cut out for us, don't we? Culture's changed, hasn't it? You are markers for somebody. You're a lighthouse and a beacon for somebody. You're a power player. You may feel impotent. You don't have to be. If you're the head of a house, you're the appointed leader. Let God use your life to mark the people that you influence. Invest it. Don't spend it. And if you've not been living it, let me say this way. If you've not been living it, first of all, determine that you can live it by God's grace. And secondly, consider talking to your family and saying, you know what? I realize I've not been focused on the things that really matter. I want to be. I'm going to endeavor to be the man God built me to be, the father He built me to be, the husband He built me to be. I'd like you to pray for me. And when you have the opportunity, help me. But it's in my heart. It's a great way to launch if you want to get on track. Can God's men say amen? All right, that's all I've got to say on this Sunday morning, okay?